This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Sometimes in a moment of social unrest, it's hard to look past our own backyard. To keep things in a global perspective, Lake Effect has long called upon Carthage College professor Art Sear. He joins Lake Effect's Julian Haida to discuss the past and present of global protest.
Now, the first thing that I wanted to ask you about has to do with civil disobedience. I think a lot of people look to the United States from the outside as this country built from an anti-monarchical revolution centuries ago already. People might remember even no more than 50 or so years ago, the civil rights movements, the protests that happened all across the country, and they think that America is this bastion of democracy and civil disobedience. But it's been 50 years since we've seen the kind of protest that we've been seeing the last couple weeks, months, and years. So do you think that we've lost something in the last several decades that perhaps other countries still use us as an example of?
The country is built on revolution, as you indicated, and we're a country that changes economically and socially, and in terms of population and lots of other things, in a very constant way compared to other more traditional societies in the world, in my opinion. You'd asked about comparing the 60s to today. In the 1960s, there was a very violent dimension to civil rights protest movements, anti-war protest movements, college campus, very radical, often undefined protest movements. It was also a time when we had an extraordinarily high crime rate from the 1950s into the 1990s. I don't know why we had such high crime rates, an unusual thing for a professor or others on the media to say. There are lots of theories and explanations, and people have views. I myself am not convinced by any single explanation, but the fact is that was a very violent time, including terrible political assassinations that you and I discussed off the air briefly. And that is not the case today. But as for demonstrations in America, no, I think they're very American.
That's very interesting, considering how certain political discourses in the United States today seem to have a sense of nostalgia, no matter what kind of one's ideological position is, but a nostalgia for the 60s, whether you're a black protester imagining one's kind of alliance with, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., or perhaps if you are someone more sympathetic towards a kind of a white suburban, affluent kind of lifestyle, invoking the 1960s as this time of kind of respectable safety. So what does that kind of ideological rereading of history imply for today? Is it just kind of foolish, or like how do you see people who try to apply history to today in such a kind of heavy-handed manner?
Well, we all have bias in how we view the world, and it's important to be aware of that, no matter who you are. In American history, we tend to distill the truth eventually. The fact that Dr. King is so durable is very reassuring to me. I think he's quite rightly respected, revered, and the subject of statues that honor him. And that was not the way it seemed to be at the time. Likewise, Abraham Lincoln. So we have our own reading of history, but eventually there is a consensus that, from my point of view, goes in the right direction in America.
Well, that's very interesting in the sense that, I've spent the last couple of years reading a great deal of Dr. Martin Luther King's speeches, and you're right. I mean, there's a federal holiday. Children have to learn about them in school. There are monuments and statues. And yet sometimes the takeaway is I have a dream, or we can live in peace and harmony. But some of the content of his speeches were angry. He felt dejected. He was depressed. He came out later in life against the Vietnam War and talked about corporations shifting profit overseas. Now, that kind of complicates our understanding of him. So do you think that we can often use that kind of retrospect in a manner that sanitizes people, even as kind of saintly as they may have been?
Yeah, no, Martin Luther King was no saint. And I think the most effective leaders in terms that you and I and we in this country, in terms of the values and goals that we collectively respect and seek, people who are morally upright and have no shortcomings whatsoever tend not to do that well in the political arena. Another man had brief statements, unlike me, for instance. Abraham Lincoln mentioned more than once that in his career, the people he'd encountered who had absolutely no vices whatsoever didn't seem to have many virtues either. I think Dr. King personifies the human experience in the best sense, when he was at his best. I hope that's clear. You're raising a really, to me, profound point.
Well, thank you for entertaining it. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM 89.7, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Haida, and with me is Arthur Sear. He is the director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College and author of After the Cold War. Now, I wanted to get a little bit into that kind of post-Cold War politics and to see how it might relate to some of what we've been talking earlier. We think about the Cold War, great power politics being over, but Russia and increasingly China are kind of increasing their spheres of influence. And within what they perceive to be their spheres of influence, there have also been massive protest movements. Some have protested the role of police powers, extradition powers in the case of Hong Kong. How does their approach to fighting Russia or China in the name of these principles differ from ours within our own country when, for example, there's an anti-police brutality protest?
That's a very good question. And to give you a pointed response, more pointed than I've been giving, the basic commitment to human freedom, to basic equality under the law, understood as the kind of law that we accept in the US, in Great Britain, in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, most of Europe, especially the Western part, that kind of rule of law is becoming, since the Cold War, increasingly widespread and pervasive. There are cultural differences, to be sure, but people in Hong Kong and Taiwan now has a representative political system, a representative government with party alternation. And what's going on elsewhere in the world, that represents a movement in our direction.
Well, and goodness knows the events of the 20th century, even the ways, I don't know, reparations from World War II were structured directly influences everything we understand about money today. I mean, like, it's hard to underestimate the effects that the mid-20th century had on everything in our lives today.
After the Great Revolution engineered by Deng Xiaoping, people's socialism from the late 70s, but especially the early 90s, the Chinese were most anxious to join the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the other economic arms of the UN. They're already, of course, part of the General Assembly and the Security Council. The Americans and our allies and other friendly governments were very effective during the first Bush and Clinton administrations in ensuring that they came in, but that Taiwan did too, as a semi-separate entity. The end of the Cold War and rigid ideological confrontations and the end of communism, in effect, has meant that the door is open for negotiation, pragmatism, the kind of traditional diplomacy at which our British friends have excelled. They ran the world in real terms for more or less 200 years, and which Americans are increasingly good at, in my view. Again, the world is moving in our direction, and there's much more openness for our kind of law and reasonable diplomacy.
It's interesting that you mention kind of the British style of diplomacy, and we're talking just a moment ago about the legacy of the 20th century, and I'm wondering how much the legacy of the 21st century, the early 21st century, will be a kind of taking back that legacy. I mean, I think of Brexit, which was not a shining moment for British diplomacy. Meanwhile, the United States' relationship with the United Nations is crumbling, despite the UN being headquartered here. There's a kind of rising nationalism, whether it be in the UK, in the US, or even Russia and China, that makes it difficult to kind of stand on principle and makes it easy to just choose a country that's on your side.
The British have never been comfortable economically in Europe in terms of limiting institutional commitments. At the same time, they have been committed historically, I mean for hundreds of years, to playing an influential and powerful role militarily and diplomatically again in Europe. They orchestrated the broad international coalition that defeated Napoleon. They put in place a concert of Europe that more or less kept the peace for a century till the First World War. They were instrumental in bringing the U.S. into both world wars, especially before the First World War. The Germans were extremely aggressive and to some extent successful, especially in Mexico, and could have turned American public opinion the other way. The British were instrumental in getting the U.S. and Canada into NATO at the end of the 40s. They're among our closest allies in military terms. They were the only real ally that we had in our war in Iraq, launched by the second Bush administration. And they remain firmly committed to NATO. The president complains and criticizes a lot of people in a lot of countries, of course, but he keeps bringing up the fact that our allies have to do more for the alliance. One point of fact, the British are one of very few countries, others being mostly smaller countries in South and Eastern Europe, who've lived up to their NATO obligations, rain or shine, long-term. Some of the best soldiers I've ever met, I don't want to personalize this, but I did spend some time in the U.S. Army a long time ago, the Australians, and a few British officers as well, they have an extraordinarily effective military tradition. They're not as numerous as some other armies, but it's really good they're on our side. And I would keep this in mind, given all the hand-wringing and alarm, including in Britain, about Brexit, shorthand for leaving the European Union.
Well, I'd love to keep chatting about this, but we're out of time. Professor Sear, thanks so much for joining us here on Lake Effect again.
Thank you so much.
Art Sear is director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College and author of After the Cold War. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida.